And we're on. This is Regina Kong with the Hobbit Hole Oral History Project. Today I'm with Dennis Montgomery on July 30th, 2019 at his home in Gull Cove. Could we start just by having you restate your name for me and tell me a little bit about where you were born?
My name's Dennis Montgomery. I was born in Portland, Oregon in 1955. And I lived there until I got out of high school. And then I moved around. Was up here a lot and ended up in Washington State in the wintertime. And then met Peggy and we had kids and then moved down to Reno 10 years ago or so. But we're here most of the summer and all of the summer. I've been here more and more of the time. I would stay here in the winter if she would, but she's not interested in that. So I came up out of high school. I went to Ketchikan, become a logger, actually. I took the ferry up and built a little camp right out of town and went to the employment office and asked them if they had a job for me to go logging. And they said, "Do you have your corks?" And I said, "What are those?" And those are the boots you wear when you log, and you have to have them, and everyone has their own. And said, they knew that I didn't know anything, so they didn't have a job for me that day. They told me to come back to look at the used clothing store. So on my way back to my camp, the guy said, "What are you doing?" He was sitting on a bench, and he asked me to stop me and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Oh, I came up to become a logger." He said, "You don't want to do that. You ought to go fishing." And I said, "Well, how do you do that?" He said, "Well, you just walk up and down every dock and knock on every boat and ask if they need crew." And that was a really good time because the summer season's over and we've had 3 weeks off and we have a fall chum season coming up and there's a good shot that someone's left and someone needs crew. And so I did that and I got a job and made $600 cash in 2 days in 1973 when I was 18 years old. So that was a lot of money and I never got a job. I just went fishing. I never had to work construction or go logging or get a job as an engineer. I got a degree in engineering, but I didn't ever have to get a job in it. So that was good.
Why logging in the first place?
Oh, in Oregon, logging is a big thing, and I just didn't know about fishing. And so I thought, well, and I like to cut trees down, so. Chainsaws are one of my favorite tools, but it just made sense that you go to Alaska and go logging. You know, I didn't know about fishing, so it never crossed my mind.
And Alaska was the place you wanted to be.
Get away from Oregon. You know, get up away from the summer heat. So that's what I don't like it hot. So I figured out that you could come up here and it wouldn't be too hot. So.
Yeah, what was it like growing up in Oregon? What did your parents do?
My mom, well, they were divorced when I was two in 1957. My dad was in advertising. And my mom raised four kids, and she was a school teacher and then real estate broker and then her agent, I guess, and then moved to Central Oregon and continued in real estate. And she had married a guy when I was 13, and he was an engineer, and he did his engineering wherever he went after they left Portland. He just was freelance and was a structural engineer, designed 150 buildings in Bend, Oregon, of the, the commercial buildings. I'm guessing, that's a total shot, who knows, a lot of them. And then they both passed away recently, and they're all history, and here we are.
And do you have siblings?
I have two sisters. One talks to me and one doesn't. But, that's how it goes. And then I had a brother. He died when he was 27, and I was 24. And the sisters, the one that talks to me is in Juneau, and she talks nicely to me. So it's all good.
The other one just doesn't talk.
Yeah. So, my brother had met Paul Kaiser in college at Oregon State University, and made friends with him. He lived in Juneau. And so I knew there was someone up here that I could go, I had a destination friend to go visit anyway on the way through. So once I got done fishing that fall, I only fished a couple weeks, and then I took the ferry up to Juneau, visited with Paul, and then took the ferry up to Haines, and then hitchhiked up to Anchorage, and then took the train to Fairbanks, and then hitchhiked down back home. I made a hammock out of purse seine web, and then got on a freight train in a boxcar and set up a hammock that was really comfortable.
Out of what?
Purse seine web, the fish net.
Oh, uh-huh.
They were working on nets all the time. There's always scraps. And so I grabbed some scraps and made a hammock, and it came in useful when I was on the way home. And you can ride in a boxcar very comfortably.
Is that something that a lot of people do?
Pardon me?
Is that something a lot of people do, ride in a boxcar?
No, it was just, we did that back when we were younger. Mm. We don't do it anymore. Now I got into Montana and Great Falls, Montana, and got a boxcar headed west, and I woke up and somewhere a lot closer in Washington State, and it was great. Good way to travel when it works. It's not that warm very often.
Yeah. What kind of things were you interested in as a kid? And do you find that you still have some of those things that you're really obsessed with now?
I don't know what that answer is. I guess one of the things I always have done as a kid was fixing things, and that's what I have to continue to do now, and I'm kind of tired of it because something's always broken and has to get repaired. So, this place is nice and challenging. It's got all of the problems of a small city, so we get to manage it that way. So, there's electricity, there's water, there's everything to do. So it keeps me busy. But I can't think of anything specifically that I used to do. Build a go-kart, but I don't build go-karts anymore. Mm-hmm. I didn't really.
Or things that you really loved as a kid and you still sort of love now?
Not necessarily. I'm just like doing what I do.
Yeah.
I don't have anything specific that I can say about that.
And do you remember what was going on in your head when you first came to Alaska?
Well, yeah, I was just going to go get a job and start something new and see what's going on. I'd already tried working at a gypsum wallboard plant in Wyoming, and it was hot. It was in the summertime, and I didn't enjoy the hot part. So I was looking for somewhere that was cooler to work. And I knew about chainsaws. I didn't know about much else, so it seemed like it would work.
Yeah.
I still do use a lot of chainsaws. My kids are getting tired of it. I'm on a limited cutting here now. I have to get approval of anything I do. Oh. If I'm going to cut a tree down here, Alice has to approve of when I do this. Not okay anymore for me to just do what I want.
If you could describe how you feel when you use a chainsaw, what would you say? Like, why do you think you enjoy it so much?
It's just getting the firewood and just the power that you have. You know, you got to do it right. You got to follow the tree right, or you're gonna wreck something. So there's a lot of this. That's. I have a winch though. I always set up a winch anymore because I've made enough mistakes now. I can still make mistakes though. And, yeah, it's kind of, I don't know. Yeah, following a tree, you got to do it. By doing it just right, there's an art to it. And that's the fun part, is doing it right.
Now, are these things that you sort of learn just by trial and error?
Yes, everything I've learned is trial and error. I don't learn very well from other people. But, yeah, I used to cut trees down in a real funny way. And then I started figuring it out. But I have it down now, pretty much.
Anyway, is that the same way with fishing? When you first started out, what was that like?
When I first started out, I didn't know anything, and I didn't go fishing with somebody else. I just got a little boat and started fishing. So I wasn't tying the knots right. Everything was coming apart. And I wasn't very successful at first, and I always had a messy boat. And I'd always come back in when the boat was a little bit tidier, and I'd have a pile of fish after a while. And now I'm back to a little boat. I've had a big boat. I got bigger and bigger boats, and then I got smaller and smaller boats. Now I'm down to about as small as you can get for what I'm doing. So it's okay. If there were some more fish, I'd be catching more. But it's an odd year. Things are odd.
You mean as far as the fish?
Yeah. Hmm. Not very many are coming inside at Three Hill, but there might be some around. We'll see.
Is that a trend that's been happening over the past couple
of
years?
No, we've had good fishing for ever since I've been here. For 40 years, we've had really good fishing. It's just this is the first time in July we haven't had any fish, and it's not a good sign. Mm-hmm. It's not. I don't think it's just a 1 year's scenario thing. I think we're having ocean survival problems. I think, but I don't know. Mm-hmm. I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah.
But it's very late. This end of July, and still no fish at Three Hill. And I went offshore too today. I went out 3 miles, 3.5 miles, and there wasn't enough there. I caught one fish, and the boats that I saw a boat just keep going past, you know, charging off, and I wasn't willing to go out further. It was an offshore wind, and I'm not going to go further out in that little boat and without a friend. I saw some people I know, but I wasn't going to. It just wasn't worth it to be out there. So I went back to Three Hill and caught 4 more cohos and came home.
Did you fish with deckhands?
Yeah. With long lining, you have to have deckhands. And then with trolling, I have deckhands off and on. Mm-hmm. And sometimes not. Sometimes I did. I always have to be a participant, though. So I wasn't a very good long liner. A good long liner is in the wheelhouse and driving the boat and yelling at the guys in the back. And the water's washing up to their knees and the decks are awash with fish and the skipper's in there chatting with the other skippers on the radio. I couldn't do that. So that's how you really do well, is just make everybody else do the work. I mean, you know, it's a lot of planning and talking, and that's, you know, someone's got to drink the coffee and stay warm. I was always had to be out there doing all the work with the guys, and so. And I was a real gentleman about laying fishing gear out, and so I wasn't very good at it.
So when does the Hobbit Hole come in?
I got it 1973 and 1974 in the fall. I went up in Purse Seine and out of Ketchikan, and then I guess it would be the 75 that I brought a Boston Whaler up, a 16-foot Boston Whaler, and started hand trolling at Point Baker. And I stayed down there for 2 years. The next 2 years I fished down that area and slowly figured it out. And then I came up here and knew about the Hobbit Hole because my brother knew about Paul Kaiser, and Paul Kaiser knew about Greg and Fred. Mm-hmm. And so I knew that there was a place to check out. And I came up and went through South Indian Pass and could see Uncle Roy fishing pink salmon. And he was in the Wandry. It's a flat calm. He's in one spot, going back and forth, catching fish after fish after fish. And I go, that looks good. So I started fishing out of Elephant Cove and then introduced myself to the boys over at the Hobbit Hole. And one of the first things I did at the Hobbit Hole, I wasn't really used to tides. I wasn't really thinking, and they didn't have much of a dock. So I was sleeping at the dock in my Boston Whaler, and they had me up for dinner. And then I was supposed to take the little boat back out to the dock, and I did. But I tied it to the piling instead of the dock. And so the tide came in and then went back out. So when Greg came out in the morning, the boat was unusually full of water and the outboard had been underwater and it never ran again. And Greg forgave me. He never found fault with me for being stupid. I don't know how he did that, but didn't do it again. But it was a bad one. But it was great. I had a place to stay, and I stayed on my boat, but I had a place to visit. I wasn't there that much that year, but I'd stop in a lot. And then there was more and more. As I got bigger boats, that was the place I'd tie up instead of Elton Cove. And it was great. I ended up with a 50-foot boat, which is a little bit tricky to get into the Hobbit Hole. Mm-hmm. But we managed. 50-foot. Yeah, and I froze fish for 8 years with it, and it was really enjoyable, but my kids were growing up, and I didn't want to be away from the kids anymore, so I built this place instead. That was the plan. And it's worked. We've had a great time here. The girls have grown up around adults, and we've made a lot of friends. And we had an option to buy the Hobbit Hole, but we don't have the money, and we already have this place. We didn't have the option to buy the Hobbit Hole. The Hobbit Hole would be cool to own if we could afford it, but this is already enough to have this place occupied in the winter. And I'm glad that it did turn into a lodge, and Elfin Cove's overrun with lodges, and the Mormons could have got it. That would have been bad. Anyway, the Hobbit Hole was a lot of fun. Greg really supported us a lot and kept it together, and we got it to where there's enough food going out that we pitched in money and pooled money and got groceries together. And there's one famous story when we got people got tired of having to do the dishes because we're working hard, we're fishing, so we got paper plates, and that was great. And it was when we were still sitting down in one place and not doing a buffet. Deborah made a big lasagna and had it on the white linoleum table. And Ron Creer, my brother-in-law, was an energetic deckhand for Greg, and he had a couple of paper plates, and he had three helpings of lasagna. And when he went to clear his plates from the table, the rings of the plates were left, but the center of the plates were both gone. He had consumed the plates with the, or enough of the paper plate to be missing. He had eaten it with the lasagna. The whole thing wasn't completely gone, but he had consumed a paper plate or two. There's quite a few times that the Hobbit Hole was wild with just happy, wild people. It, when it was a small room, when the house was small before the expansion, there was maybe 30 people in the living room and the kitchen and the little breakfast room, and there was generally not very many, maybe one or two conversations going on because the room was so small. And then when the building got expanded, then there was more different conversations going on because it wasn't such a condensed area. And it was, that's kind of how bars work and different things. There's different, it gets it smaller. But it changed it a little bit. It was good. It's a good expansion. They found trade beads. I think you guys probably have them. I don't know if they kept them or not, but the trade beads they found underneath the foundation. And we have found stone tools here. We haven't found any trade beads, but we have a lot of what we know to be good stuff. But we've seen, we don't really have, but we've seen stone tools, and we know that the trees are all culturally modified where people have hacked at them over the years. If you walk around here, they all are scarred like a logging scar. Mm-hmm. And then this land's 20 feet above where it was 200 years ago because it's rising out of the water, isostatic rebound. So the trees below 20 feet elevation aren't marked because the natives left the land when the white people came. But the trees above 20 feet are almost all scarred, where this place was inhabited by natives a lot.
Why were they scarred?
To get them to bleed pitch. They used it for patching cracks in the canoe and everything else that you could use an epoxy for. They used it. We can't imagine how many uses they had. I'm thinking there's some part that could have been edible and you mix it with berries or something. I'm not sure, but they did it to every tree, so there's a real reason for it. Mm. It'd be an experiment to see if you can eat it. I always think that, they get maple syrup out of those trees. Why don't we get something out of these trees that we can eat? But anyway, they were very creative, and they needed the stuff. It's what they had. So. Mm. They call it culturally modified tree. And so I'm sure the chief was sitting around, why don't you kids go out there and culturally modify a few more trees?
So there are those trees around the Hobbit Hole, too.
Yeah, they're all over. Okay. Anywhere. See, the Hobbit Hole was a big camp, and this was a big camp. This is, if you look at this from a chart, and then you look at Hoonah, they're exactly the same. As they have southern exposure, they're in the lee of the northerlies, and there's fresh running water. That's the three things you really needed And this spot was a big camp. There was a lot of people here. You can still see evidence, and I'm sure if you looked hard, you'd find more. Over there on the other side, too, there's people over there. It's harder to haul a canoe out over there. In the stream bed, you could do it real easily. Take you for a walk there sometime.
I want to ask you, do you remember what your first impression was of the Hobbit Hole when you saw it for the first time?
Well, when I went up in the ferry and I saw that someone could have a home on the salt water and it wasn't the ocean where the waves were crashing, you know, I thought, well, that's pretty cool because I hadn't really seen that before. And so I thought that, and that's kind of became my goal, and I got to end up with that. But that was, the Hobbit Hole was just that. As far as the buildings and everything, I hadn't seen anything in a pocket like that. I'd only seen places from a big boat, so you didn't see anybody really hidden away. So that was an interesting part of it. I didn't really relate to the native part of it, and the cultural part. I didn't understand that part for a long time. And then I finally went, oh, geez, yeah, I get it. You know, why this would be the place to hang out. And Elfin Cove was a place, too. They've got some stone tools from over there that have been found. And they kayaked and canoed. They canoed from Yakutat to here. You know, we don't do that. We barely take our big boats.
How far is that?
It's a 24-hour run. It's a couple hundred miles, 180 miles or something. I don't know. I've been there a couple times, and the first time I went, I didn't catch anything. And the second time I went, I learned how to fish there. And it's not really that much fun. You don't really get to anchor up. You're off the beach. You're 20 miles from an anchorage, so if you anchor right in the surf, and that's not great. So it's kind of unsettling. The other thing, you run offshore and drift for the night. So, and there's a lot of dogfish. There's little salmon sharks, not salmon sharks. They're dog salmon, not dog salmon. They're dogfish. There's little sharks about this long, and they chew your fish apart.
Oh.
And it's murky water. And so you pull your coho up, and it's like this, and there's all these guys chewing on it, get it out of the water. There's fish there.
Did you have pretty good fishing up around the Hobbit Hole, though?
The fishing around the Hobbit Hole was always really good. When I guess one of my favorite memories was Greg had gotten to use Fred's boat, the Emily L. Fred had taken the sailboat, his folks' sailboat, and gone up Glacier Bay for a couple weeks, so Greg had the Emily L, and they were hand trolling, and it's just when the pinks and chums and sockeye, coho fish, with ignoring the king salmon in the passes, the value of those was going up pretty quickly. The eggs for the chum were important, and just the value of salmon at the time was good. So I was tied to the dock. The Hobbit Hole, and Greg came down, and he was kind of steaming because he was so excited. He said, "We had a $500 day yesterday." You know, and it was really good. And they started learning how to fish humpies and the multi-species in the passes, and he could do that and be home by 3 and 4 in the afternoon. And no one else could do that. And you can't fish somewhere and actually go to your own home and take a shower and sit down and listen to the news, and nobody else fishing gets to do that. And so that was a real privilege. And we all got to do it. And right now, the fish aren't there, or else it'd still be happening. But it'll change. And it just was a real... A lot of work got done. Greg enjoyed all the help. There was a lot of gardening done. There was a lot of... volleyball and late night. I could never stay up late and party with everybody the way they did. One of our funniest things, a joke I pulled, we had a guy, Pat Fisher, and he was a little older than the rest of everyone, and he was always playing practical jokes on you. Hey, what's that? And then hit you, you know, that hit you in the nose. And So one night he'd gone to bed and I said, hey, let's, he's been down there, he's been in bed for about half an hour. Let's go down and let him think it's, this was in the middle of June, so let's go down and let him think it's morning. Okay, so, and he's tied outside of Greg, and no one ties outside of Greg, and if Greg's ready to go, it's, you got to, you know, you're, it's wrong to be tied still, because Greg wants to go. It's Greg's dock. So we go down there, and we try to mess with his alarm, can't get it to work, so we start the boat on either side of him. That doesn't wake him up, and everyone's down there waiting, and so I jump down and open the door and say, hey, Patrick, Greg's ready to go. And he wakes up, goes, oh, shit, and he gets dressed, and starts his engine and goes out on deck and he's untying his lines and he's only been asleep for 20 minutes, you know. He's untying his lines and starts looking around and he sees people standing around smiling. That's not what the morning would be like. They'd all be in their own beds, you know, being woken up too. So he figured it out. It was a really good joke. So he burned his foot. He went up to Cape's Icy Point and was making coffee the way he regularly does, and the boat was tossing and turning, and the coffee cone spilled on his foot, so he lost some fishing time. Oh. Doesn't take much. And if you're not used to the boat tossing and turning like that, anything like that can happen. It was a really good one.
Were there many accidents that happened when...
No. No. There's... surprisingly few. Jacques Nergal landed his float plane in the, right in the hobbit hole. No accident there. Nobody does that.
Why is that?
It's just too short of a runway. You know, you got to come down off of the trees and get it right down, and then stop it.
Why did he decide to do that?
He likes to do things like that. He's a good pilot. He likes to show. He likes to do it right. He's a good guy. He's off. He's retired now. He was our sky king. He would come through here and tear the sky apart. It was irritating for a while, and then I finally said, I just got into it, you know. It's like, if your wife likes the Rolling Stones, get some big speakers. Don't complain, you know. Right?
What were some of the other, jokes or things that happened at the Hobbit Hole?
Well, the talent show was a really fun one. I'm not sure just what year that was, but there was a closure or something, and we all got together and had a talent show, and everybody came up with something. That was a hoot. There's a video of that that they have. I don't know if you've seen it, but there's a VHS video of it. And Greg rolls two propane tanks at the same time. The girls sing. There's quite a few different little skits and other jokes that happened.
Do you remember what you did for the talent show?
Oh, yeah. I narrated a poem by Robert Service, and Bob Bell and his wife acted it out. It's called The Three Bears. Oh. And, you'll have to look it up. Anyway, that was a good one. And there was just different people did different stuff, but everyone was sitting in the yard and had chairs, and it was when video cameras first came out, and Fred had a video camera, so Fred did the video of the whole thing. So there's a record of it. And then
I heard something about you and Bobo peeling a carrot. And
right, that was one of the skits. So one of the skits was it was Conley's skit, was you have to eat a carrot. And I try to keep a candle lit, and he tries to keep his candle lit. I try to blow his candle out, but I have to eat my carrot. So you end up spitting carrots over each other's candle and each other. And you keep trying to light your candle and blow it out. And carrots are going all over. It's pretty funny. And those things just don't happen that often, where you get enough people together and have a silly thing like that go on. So it was good. I can't, it was just continuous hilarity of some sort. Captain Snooze, Gary Phillips, he came in one time, he had kind of a mess, he had a hand troller, and we were selling fish eggs at the time, and they sent some egg technicians out from town because they were having a little trouble with the quality of eggs they were receiving in town. And so Snoozy's spraying his boat down. He's got the name Captain Snoozy. He could sleep like no one. But he was spraying his boat down and had delivered his eggs, and he talks to the egg technician, and the technician says, "Yeah, feces." And Snoozy says, "Yeah, they came from fishes." And the technician said, "No, no, feces smells like shit." Because they were rotten. And so he'd had them for 2 or 3 days and thought he could still sell them. And it wasn't, you know, he didn't do that often, but it was a really funny story for him to tell. And we had Mike Russell here for a while as he was in medical school. And so he would get on the radio and be Dr. Science and spout off for 20 minutes something he'd been studying. And that was a hoot. He and his wife hand-trolled 2,000 pounds of pink salmon and had them dressed and sold. That was a record. No one had done that. That's a lot of fish. They had 1,800 pounds, and so they had to go back out and get 200 more. You know, they had it almost had a record. We got to go.
How long did that take them to do that?
It was a day, in one day. I don't know how much of a day, but there was some part of the day left when it was over. They could have caught more, but they didn't want to. It's 400 or 500 fish hand cranking. That's a lot of work. And the fish were thick. They were just all on every hook, as long as you could.
Wow. You know. What year do you think that was about?
It was in the early 90s. I'm guessing. I don't know. It'd have to be in the mid 80s, because that was before Peggy. Yeah, it was mid 80s. It's hard to keep track of all that time. I had different friends come up and visit and check out trolling, and several. Tim Parker got his own troller and tried it, and you know, did it for a summer and decided that maybe there's other jobs out there, and developed his own whole other business on his own. And Mike Russell finished medical school and became a doctor. Nobody else really, you know, they came up to visit and try it out. And, oh, I don't know, Dan. So it worked out for me.
Why do you think it was different for you?
Oh, I wasn't, I just wanted to be up here and get some kind of place like this going. And I wasn't trying to do anything else. Once I learned that I could make a living catching fish and didn't have to send in a report or show up for work or, you know, take a day off if I felt like it, which I didn't. If I felt like it, I could. Mm-hmm. But I didn't very often.
And were you fishing year-round?
Just in the summertime.
And so you could make enough money in the summer to live on for the rest of the year?
That was the beauty. You work your butt off for 3 months or 5 months, and then you don't do anything. And so I lived in Port Townsend, built a little cabin, and was a, what's they call them, shed boys in Port Townsend. And so then at the Hobbit Hole, then after Jane moved in, it got kind of, it was less communal, and it got to be more, you know, there was a couple living there, and it wasn't practical to have 30 people living with them. You know, it just wasn't practical as far as their life goes. And so people started to slowly figure that out on their own, and I think maybe some people had to be told. I'm not sure, but we've always been welcome and always and had many dinners there and everything ever since. But it just became less of a place where you can just hang out and not do anything if you didn't want to. You know, most everybody always did something, but that was good. That was quite a while ago too. Mm-hmm. So Jane came up to meet to visit Peggy. Did you know that?
Because we went to high school together, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's how that connection came on.
Is that the first time you met Peggy?
No, I met Peggy when I went on a trip to Mexico with Bob Bell. And I was...
And you met him at the Hobbit Hole?
Yeah, Bob Bell at the Hobbit Hole.
Was he called... Where does Bobbo come from?
I don't know. Just something different than Bob. I'm not sure where the O comes from. We also call him Bob Zero, which is an O. He's a good guy. He's pretty much only going to fish if it's good fishing, and he's not fishing right now. Yeah. Waiting for it to get a little better.
So you met Peggy in San Francisco?
Right. Mm-hmm. I visited my best friend from junior high, high school, Joe Wagner. He's married to his sister, her sister, Martha. And no one introduced me to Peggy. And Mike Russell had actually been out with Peggy and driven right by my house and didn't introduce her to me. So I had to figure it out for myself. But we've had a lot of fun. We don't get very many girls from Reno up here. But then it ended up that Peggy was here. Marilyn Bell from Reno was up the way. And Jane Button was over there. And it turned out that Marilyn's... See, how did this work? Someone's clothes... Peggy used to inherit Jane Archer's clothes... And somehow, someone else's clothes, there was a three-way connection on people's clothes being passed around of people that didn't know each other. And someone ended up with someone's, but I'm not sure exactly how it worked. But there was different families were interconnected in Reno, not knowingly, and it ended up here too.
Wow. And did you know that you liked Peggy from the moment you met her?
Oh, it made sense, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was really fun. Always has been. She's always on the fun side of things.
And then once Annie was born, did you feel that changed things for you at the Hobbit Hole? Having a family?
Yeah, it was... Yeah, we didn't, our options were live on the boat or live somewhere. So we rented a house in Elfin Cove, the high rise, and that worked out okay for a summer. But we had gotten a big boat, and so I was struggling to do the big boat thing, and we had a new baby, and we were doing that. And they came out fishing a little bit, but they stayed in Elfin Cove. And then we ended up buying a little float house. And that sort of worked out, and we had a place, but we had it in I put it on the beach in the front of Elfin Cove, and it was not good because waves would crash up under it at night, and she had to walk down a trail where the brown bears were hanging out, and so we moved it from there, and had it over at the Hobbit Hole for a year, and then moved it back to Elfin Cove in the back harbor, and then we had the twins, so the twins were back there. And Annie, and it was a nice place for all the kids in the back harbor of Elfin Cove. I was pretty happy back then. And then we decided to build this place. And so we left that float house there for them and lived over here from then on. And the twins were 3 or so when we built this. That was my midlife crisis was I just couldn't go freezing fish and out on the ocean when I had these 3 beautiful kids to hang out with. And we could do something different. And the IFQ system where they took the halibut and black cod and divided it up for themselves really pissed me off. And so I had to do something that they couldn't take away from me. Or they can't set my rates or tell me what to do. Well, if I'd had the right attitude and bought into the IFQ system, I'd be a millionaire. And I'd have a big boat. And Peggy said, yeah, and you'd be divorced. So
explain what the IFQ system is.
The North Pacific Fisheries Management Council, so 9 people from 4 different states appointed by governors, in their great wisdom, took the longline fishery of halibut and black cod and took a person's historical record, the first 7 years in the 1980s, and issued quota shares to individuals based on their records. And those became saleable quota shares.
Oh.
It was a public resource in 1994. In 1995, it changed into a private resource. The public ended up with 11% of the halibut. There was no sport fish representation on the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council. It was all industry people. Sport fish are now held to 11% still when it was a public resource. It was always a public resource. It is no longer a public resource. It is a private resource. And it is wrong. And the commercial guys buy and sell. And I sold what I had. I was issued 40,000 units. So at the time, I was could catch 6,000 pounds of halibut. So I sold that, I think it was $10 a pound or so at the time, and got $60,000 to help build this place. And then the quota, they realized they were, well, the guys fishing had to take longer and longer to catch their quota, and really long time. And they found out they were overfishing the hell out of it. And so they changed the quota. They just cut it in half. So the 6,000 pounds I would have caught went to 3,000 pounds. And a couple of years later, they said, oh, you're catching too many. So that went in half again. So I would have been down to 1,500 pounds. So it wouldn't have been enough to stay in the game. I would have had to buy in. And it just wasn't the thing. But to this now, what's happening is the charter guys are pinched. Well, everyone, the public is pinched to 11% of the halibut quota, and the commercial has the 89%, and that is what's going on to this day. And so the charter guys are pinched down to one fish per person, 34 inches or less for halibut, and our guys can still catch two fish of any size per day, but it's changing, and next year it'll be one fish of whatever size they'll tell us. I'm not sure. I don't mind that. I think it's a good thing for these guys to slow down. They don't need more than a couple boxes of fish. And we don't encourage that at all. But the public, you know, and they did the same thing with the airwaves. The federal government took the radio wavelengths and divvied it up and sold it. You know? So it's a saleable entity now, and it was public before. So I don't like that kind of stuff. So
you said that was part of your midlife crisis?
Yeah, I couldn't buy in. It was part of my income, and I morally could not buy into the program, and it crushed me because I knew that it would be a way to make a living. I could make a lot of money, and but I couldn't do it. So I had to do something else.
And that's when you decided to do this place.
Yeah.
And how have you liked this business?
Well, this has been great. Yeah, I thought we'd make a lot of money, and we made enough, but we made a lot of friends, and that's the best part. And the kids grew up with a lot of adult interactions, and that helped them a lot. So it's been great. And I'd fished enough on the, you know, now I'm still fishing, but I like being on land, and now I'm gardening. I didn't have a garden before. You know,
garden too.
Yeah, it's working out. So. We have solar panels today. The batteries are totally charged up. And we got all the freezers could be on. Everything's happening. It's great when the sun shines. It'll work.
And when you were fishing at the Hobbit Hole, was there ever a sense of competition between you and all the other fishermen?
Well, we had certain people are competitive just because they are. And there was always a sense of competition where you would compare, but the only real ever problem is if you'd sort of have a group that, well, if I'm catching them, I'll tell you about it, you know. Well, that works out if they, if they aren't and you are, and then when you're fishing, then you can see somebody, you know, in the distance, you don't go, hey, the fish are over here, because they're probably as likely to be as there as they are here. Or, you know, you don't really feel obligated to communicate But then there's times when you know someone's a long way away and they aren't catching, and you are catching, there's plenty of fish, and you want to have a code and let them know without telling everybody. And mm-hmm. so there's sort of a, you know, don't tell everybody. Like right now, like the kids said, there's some cohos up Idaho, and like, well, maybe, maybe not, but I told Dusty, don't tell your parents yet until I find out. Because it's a shh. Anyway, we, I don't think there was too much competition. Everyone learned from each other a lot.
Were you all experienced by that time, or still?
Yeah, mm-hmm. and people, you know, deckhands would come and go. I was always the youngest at first. I was the youngest. Then when we had bigger boats and more deckhands, there were more young people around. So, but yeah, when someone would figure something out, we'd share it and, with each other. And there was a time when we were tying humpy bugs, and it was just a swivel, and you cut up a pink hoochie and use wire because we learned from the Canadians, and everyone was tying those up. And you know, it was fun. Let's try these. Okay. And now we're still using the same hoochie called a Picked to Win. And it's the same hoochie Greg picked out about 30 years ago out of some hoochies that he thought would catch cohos. And most everybody still uses it. So.
Wow.
It's funny. And, but Greg was, the only competition was who could quit first and get home first. And Greg was the best at that. It'd be the end of the flood tide, and so at the end of the flood, the fish bite pretty well. So you get pretty excited, and you got all these fish to clean. And so you put the gear back down, and you clean your fish, and gee, the tide's ebbing, and nothing's happened. So then you reel the lines in, and you don't have anything on the gear. Oh, okay, so I'll go in. Well, Greg didn't do it that way. Here you go. End of the flood, lines are full, pull the gear, we're going in. There's a fish on every hook, pull the gear into the boat, steam off to the buyer to sell your fish. Everyone else has put their gear back down for that, you know, because they still think they're going to keep biting, and they're not, because it's all over. Because that's, you know, you've done it years and year after year enough to know that that's, it's over when they bite like that. And so then Smokes comes out of his stack, and he's off to the buyer before, and he's home having a, you know, listen to the news and have a shower, and everyone else is lined up at the buyer waiting for the next guy to sell. Because if you're late, you know, if you're the third one there and the second guy takes a long time, some people take a long time, and then three more guys come in behind you, and then there's a line of boats waiting. You got to wait. You got to unload your fish. They got to give you more ice. They got to write you a check. And you're sitting there going, oh, God, I could have pulled my gear and come in and had a drink. Damn. That was really the main competition, was getting done soon enough to get home. When Greg had to fish out on the coast and anchor up, he didn't really like that much. Not only, well, he just couldn't go home.
You like to go home.
And there was a big anxiety about king salmon openers for everybody, because a lot of fish get caught the first day, and if you're in the wrong place, somebody catches three times as much as you do. And it wasn't individual competition between me and you. It was competition being we're in the right place. And then you don't know. You know, and some places are going to be good and some places aren't going to be good.
Is it just luck then?
It's just, well, you know, some people go out and do a little test fishing, and some people have look at the tide book and know when the tides are good for a certain spot. Or yeah, there's luck. But there's a lot of knowledge that someone's gained, you know. Right now, the cohos really like the warmer water. There's warmer water offshore, and cold water here. You learn those things, and when they're not biting shore, then you just drive and drive and drive until you watch your pedometer, and as soon as it goes from 47 degrees to 55 degrees, you put your gear in the water, and then you drive, keep going, and then they start catching fish. So if you don't know that, you are in the cold water and you're fishing along, going, nothing happening. And then you finally go, well, why are those boats driving by me without even fishing? And then you follow them and you go, oh, that's why. So you just learn that stuff after a while.
And that's sort of how you learned.
Yeah. So I can go, you know, this morning I went out and I could just see by the boats that all the boats are spread out and they're all just driving along, and I'm not catching anything. I don't see any much feed on the pedometer. There's feed on the pedometer, but if there's fish, you can see that it's bunched up. So you see more of the blotchy spots. You can really, if there's salmon around, you can tell. And there weren't very many. And there's one boat just went right on by me with just charred, just running. Mm-hmm. And I could see where he's going. And it's, and I was told there's fish 7 miles off and all that. But I'm not, offshore wind, I'm not going out 7 miles without a real report. Mm-hmm. If I was guaranteed I'd get 100 fish and it was flat calm, I'd certainly go. But if I don't, I don't have anything to go on. I'm not just going to drive off towards Hawaii without more information. So, anyway, it's okay. I'm semi-retired. I'm not doing it just for fun. When the fish are in the passes, I'll actually make some money. But I have to take it with a, you know, I have to, it's a little tiny boat. I can't just do anything with it.
Right. So. How would you describe your fishing style?
I'm pretty independent, but I'm not a prospector. I'm more of a homesteader. I like to learn an area and just fish that area, where some people can go, okay, I didn't, yeah, there's a lot of too many boats here, I'll go find another spot. There's a guy, Jeff Berwin, who's just famous for being off on his own, and he always catches fish, and he just knows how to move away and still do well. I don't know where he fishes for cohos. Mostly that you have to fish out with the fleet somewhere. We have some interesting places over on the other side in the park in the fall time, Point Wimbledon, where you fish, you're trolling and you're trolling a back eddy and you punch into the rip and then you're motoring forward in the water, but the water's going 5 knots the other way, so you're actually going backwards. Mm-hmm. And you stay in front of the rip and you go backwards for 2 or 3 miles and then you turn back into the back eddy and head over towards shore, and then you're going 2.5 knots in the water, but by your GPS you're going 8 knots because the water's going. And then you punch back into the rip, and then you fish backwards for 2 or 3 miles and catch fish, and then you punch back. It's really exciting. A lot of kelp, and so you got to punch through the rip in the right place, and there's and in the laundry right by the hobbit hole, you can have 3 or 4 boats all in. Just in position there, and the current's running, and everyone catching fish, and they're just high, you know, you're just talking, you know, your lines are really close to each other, but you're not tangling, and you're not competing with each other, and everyone's catching. It's really fun. And you kind of, it's kind of like an orchestra, you have to move around if the current's a certain way. Hmm. You're obligated to move out of the rip if a boat's coming up behind you, because they keep. Can't do anything. They're coming up in a back eddy and they have to come into the rip, so you have to move away so that they get the first spot, and then you move on down, and then you turn in, and you take turns.
Have you found that your background in engineering has been pretty useful out
there? Yeah, it's been pretty vital for this place. You know, mm-hmm. I could have learned the same stuff, just practical knowledge, but I got to the degree is in general engineering, Oregon State, and I'd already figured out about fishing, but I'd kind of committed myself to go to college anyway, and I got to take a lot of oceanography courses. Again, they had a really good school there for that. So, and I combined that with the engineering, so it was really interesting to learn currents and chemical, you know, chemistry of oceans and stuff. So, mm-hmm. And I didn't bog down in any one class, and I didn't do well at it. I didn't care much, you know. I got okay grades, but I didn't freak out about any of them, and I didn't get any bad grades. But it was, you know, just got it over with.
So what are your favorite things to do now?
Oh, cut trees down. I like to just keep powdering on the place and making it nice. This spring I milled up with the chainsaw, I milled all those planks to the ramp that comes down from the greenhouse, cut some trees down. Well, actually some of them came from a log John McKenna gave me, and then I cut some trees down and made some of the other ones. And it's pretty good that I didn't discover the chainsaw mill a long time ago. I would have had to build everything with it, and it's nice to have just bought the lumber because I'd still be building stuff. But and going fishing, catching fish. Going fishing isn't so much fun, but catching fish is. But I think gardening, I've learned, you know, we didn't have a garden before. Once we put the solar panels in, the Forest Service started letting us cut their trees down to let more light in. And once we had more light in, then we built raised beds and brought some soil over from Gustavus and followed Gordy Warble over in Elfin Cove. I just do whatever he tells me to do. He said, build your beds high so you don't have to bend over. Get your soil from Gustavus. It's sandy. And he showed me how you heat your soil in the greenhouse in the spring with a 6-inch pipe that goes up to the top of the greenhouse, goes down all through the soil, and then you have a fan that sucks air. So it sucks the hot air from the top of the greenhouse down and warms the soil, and the plants grow faster. You don't need to do it after springtime, really, but everything's warm. But to get the soil up to 60 degrees is a good thing.
Mm. Do you ever miss your days at the Hobbit Hole?
No, they were fun, but we have our own fun now.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it was great, but it came to a time where we were always welcome, and we had dinners there, and we were always invited, and had a great time. It just wasn't the same as we just weren't going to hang out there at the dock, and you know, it was, you know, Greg needed his own life and his own, you know, it's fine. It worked out just right. Mm-hmm. And everybody needed to figure their own lives out too. We weren't going to be all hippies forever hanging out, you know. And at first we kind of mooched off Greg, I think, but after a while I think people pretty well pitched in financially for the food and certain people went overboard and worked really hard. Ron did a lot of gardening that really kept things going, and you know, so that's a lot of work keeping that going. Other people did too, but he was one of the master gardeners. And he's the one who drew the calendars, you know, the old calendars.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that was fun. Yeah. I guess the only thing I don't like doing at the Hobbit Hole is the fall time, the memorial. Everyone goes out to the point and holds hands and talks about people that have died and stuff. I don't like that shit. I started calling it the Circle of Death, and nobody thought that was very funny either, so I just didn't go. I show up late. Where's Dennis? He's waiting till the Circle of Death is over.
Just an eye.
I just don't like that memorial stuff much. That's okay. But no, we're having fun here. This is really very rewarding to have people come and go out on their own and catch a fish like that. He's never caught anything like that in his life. And now they're dealing with it. They're cutting it up themselves, you know. And the idea where you go out on a charter boat and someone, you know, hooks the fish and then hands you the rod and then you don't ever touch it. And they cut it up for you. I don't like that. I never did like it. So that's why we did this. And we figured 8 people's enough. There's a state law, if you serve less than 10 people, you don't need a permit for your kitchen. Mm-hmm. And so and you have family help. So we've been staying within that realm, and it's been fine. We had 10 people last week. It was a little too much. It's just stressed our systems. Freezer space and bed space. Mm-hmm. And we don't want to get any bigger.
And Alice is saying that she's probably going to take it over.
Yeah, she's running it pretty much. She's doing all the bookings and taking in the money and all that. And I'm kind of fading out and going to be fishing more. And that'll just keep me around to scare the bears away. But yeah, no, I was never very good at the sales part. And I was okay at communication, but I wasn't very good at talking to people into it. And I never really wanted to. So I used to do the sportsman shows, and they weren't very good for us. And what do you want to go to Alaska for? Bugs, rains.
And when Alice starts taking it over, are you and Peggy going to stay here?
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm not going anywhere. I'm just going to do my own thing. I'll have freedom. go camping and do other things that I get that I haven't got to do because I've been locked in, you know, and I've got people here. The more she gets, you know, she's learning more and more. There's a few more things, you know, mechanical stuff. We had to switch an outboard over the other day. Had a starter go out once. We had to take one off and one out, one in, one boat, and put it on the other. I'd have figured out a method where it isn't very much trouble. But she has to learn that method because she'll have to do it. And it works. You know, there's ways to do it easy and ways to do it hard. So the more you do it, the more you find out how easy it is.
Once you start taking a more backseat role, what are some things that you want to do? So camping.
Well, I've built that little fishing boat so I can fish more on a spontaneous basis rather than a commitment. And when the fishing is good, and it's pretty much still a team effort here. I think she doesn't really. We're going to be gone for the weekend, and that'll give her a taste of. Having people come and go without me telling her what to do, and she's totally ready for it. She's got it down. She knows to move the boats. She knows where the plane should land. She knows, you know, what to tell people, and she doesn't really need me, except for when there's a issue of a skiff, an electrical thing, or something she's not familiar with. But once she's familiar with them, then she can do them all. So we're glad that one of them wants to take over. Otherwise, I don't know what we'd do.
The other
girls have other things they're doing, so they don't have time for this. So it'll work out. It's going good.
Well, unless there's anything else you want to add.
No, it was just a real privilege to be a part of that, the Hobbit Hole, and just a privilege to catch fish for a living, a public resource. You know, what a deal. It's like sport fishing on a grand scale and getting paid for it. I hope it's not over. You start to wonder sometimes, but we'll see. They'll persevere somewhere. The thing is that trollers catch some, but a lot get away too. So you're just kind of taking a sample of the population. So there's always some that get away, which is the good thing. And all of the fisheries, some get away. But we'll just see. Well, I'm going to head up. I don't. Do you need a ride home?
No, I'm getting picked up.
Oh, are they coming all the way back?
Yeah, around 5 or 6.
Oh, we could.
I think 5 the earliest.
We could run over there.
If you're going that way, but if you're not, don't worry.
Okay, well, we'll just figure it out. We'll see if someone wants to run that way. Get some more. Yeah, no, I don't have any more. It was just a great deal. Greg was very, very generous to help us out, and he was totally entertained by it too. And he got a lot out of it, and so everybody.
I think everyone did.
Everyone benefited. It was fun. So.
All right. Thank you. All right.
Well, thank you very much.